Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled, The Sad Endurance of Tyranny. The date? January 2023. And my name is Bell Avis. I love Star Wars. As a small kid, I still remember the excitement of seeing the original movie, now called A Reason for Hope, to distinguish it from its cinematic siblings. It was not just the technology, though that was stunning, but it was more than just a burst of incredible special effects. First, there was the bar scene with all those planetary creatures. There was the majesty of Alec Guinness, the incredible charisma from an unknown trio of Carrie Fisher, who was daughter of Hollywood royalty, but nobody really knew who she was at the time, Mark Hamill, and most of all, the roguish Harrison Ford, who is the immortal Han Solo. There was humor in the scenes with Chewbacca, and one of my favorite exchanges was when a reluctant Han Solo is cajoled into helping Luke to rescue the imprisoned princess. Luke says, "She's rich," upon which Chewbacca starts moaning, knowing Luke has read Han's weakness correctly. Han says, "How rich?" And Luke says, "Well, more wealth than you can imagine." At which point Han responds, "I don't know. I can imagine quite a bit." Yet even this epic movie focused on a particular form of tyranny. The evil entity, embodied by Peter Cushing's Grand Moff Tarkin and most of all the unforgettable Darth Vader, is the Empire. To be more precise, the Galactic Empire, but no one spells that out in the movies. No, it's always the Empire, not the XXX Empire that we might know, whether it be Persian, British, Roman. No, in this case in Star Wars, it's just the Empire. It is not, though, note, the state or the regime, but rather the instant recognition of a colonizer, an occupier, an imperial government. The first three movies in the chronological order of the Star Wars movies represent the 4th, 5th, and 6th, and these are far away superior to anything that was made after. Yet one of the few good things to emanate from, well, the relatively weak prequels, was how the Empire began. Not as some massive invading and colonizing force, such as the Roman city-state conquering all around the Mediterranean Sea, but rather, the Star Wars Empire is built from within. The bureaucracy at the center of the Galactic Republic represents such an inefficient system that governance is rendered impossible. So what happens is, instead of doing the necessary reforms to make the Republic workable again, no, instead, a senator named Palpatine takes control first as chancellor and then later as emperor. And what is his excuse, his reasoning for taking ultimate power? It's to get things done. Because as I said, governance would seem to be rather weak, but he, Palpatine, was going to make it strong. Of course, he was going to do so at the removal of all liberty within what was once the Republic. Clearly, George Lucas, founder of the Star Wars franchise and writer of the prequels, was making a point. So let's start with some real-world historical examples. Napoleon Bonaparte, though Corsican, and at one point in his career Corsican nationalist, eventually joins the French army in the post-revolution time frame. Well, basically, he's a supporter of the Jacobins, is noted by Robespierre and appointed to some key positions within the army, but he is really, in this case of the revolutionary France, an establishment-type figure. After Robespierre's fall, Napoleon retains his position by beating a royalist uprising in Paris and continuing his ascent in Republican France. After more military successes, he becomes first consul and then later emperor. Again, kind of almost eerily to the fictional Palpatine. Though Benito Mussolini achieved absolute power with a march on Rome in 1922, he was a member of the Royal Army in World War I and served in the Italian Socialist Party before founding his own Fascist One. Mussolini's regimes included secret police and midnight murders of opposition figures, but one of the defenses for his governance was he made the trains run on time. Hitler was a member of the Reichstag before becoming chancellor, and The Russian peoples, they elected Vladimir Putin, and the Venezuelans elected Hugo Chavez before both ended up taking absolute authoritarian power. Now, I will provide more thoughts on this later. If the Star Wars prequels were weak, the last three movies representing movies 7, 8, and 9 in the chronological order are odious. That is why I was surprised by the excellent Star Wars TV series called Andor, based on a character that was, in turn, based on an ancillary Star Wars movie called Rogue One. Andor was a revelation. As with the best science fiction, the best sword and sorcerers, and the best superhero movies, today's special effects or CGI needs to be the servant of the story, not the other way around. The best content still tells an interesting and compelling story. Andor is set in a galaxy far, far away. It could have been placed in colonial India, 1940s France, or even Russia today. But let me be clear, there are droids and intergalactic travel and one aerial fight that was pretty tremendous, pretty cool looking. But again, part of the story, not the core of the story. Industry co-creator Conrad K noted, "To call it simply a Star Wars show is to do it a disservice. It's a political thriller, a workplace drama, a war film, a prison drama, and a spy thriller. Instead of focusing on a key family, the Empire becomes an organization governed by hierarchy, tedium, ambition, and petty bureaucracies. Everything is in detail. The show had an ability to be macro and then zero in ruthlessly on the micro. It felt local, specific, and lived in, which is remarkable for something about an intergalactic struggle. A visually spectacular romp that was somehow also able to mediate on things like the banality of evil and the importance of the revolutionary spirit." In terms of the revolutionary spirit, as noted by Kay, there is within Andor a series of speeches around the nature of tyranny and rebellion and the cost of what that means. One of the characters, one of the most compelling characters I've seen on TV of the year, is Luthen. He is not an open revolutionary, kind of running around in fatigues, but instead operates in the shadows. He's a spy. He funds, he plans, he enables other to do the wet work, or do the actual rebelling. Though he does not directly challenge the Empire, his role is vital, but it comes at a cost. When a spy he is managing demands to know what Luthen, as played by the invaluable Stellan Skarsgård, has sacrificed, he exclaims, "Calm, kindness, kinship, love. I've given up all chance at inner peace and made my mind a sunless space. I share my dreams with ghosts. I wake up every day to an equation I wrote 15 years ago from which there's only one conclusion. I'm damned for what I do. My anger, my ego, my unwillingness to yield, my eagerness to fight, they've set me on a path from which there is no escape. I yearn to be a savior against injustice without contemplating the cost, and by the time I look down, there is no longer any ground beneath my feet. What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. No, the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice? Everything." I can give you chapter and verse about Dwight Eisenhower, Bernard Montgomery, Patton, or Churchill. But have you ever heard of the name Jean Moulin? This is a name I did not really know until I researched for this piece. After losing his prefecture office during the German invasion of 1940, in which the Wehrmacht invaded France, Moulin joined the resistance and then escaped to England. He then returned to France in January 1942 as General Charles de Gaulle's delegate general for the unoccupied zone. He played a leading part in the organization of the Maquis, French guerrillas who fought the Germans, and in the development of the National Council of the Resistance, which coordinated all the non-communist resistant groups in France and secured their loyalty to de Gaulle's Free French movement. Moline became the first chairman of this council in May 1943. His organizational abilities and political skills made him a legendary figure. In June 1943, however, the Gestapo arrested him near Lyon. Tortured in one prison after another, he died on a train, taking him to Germany. In Ander, a far more idealistic character than Luthen is named Karis Nemec, who states, "There will be times when the struggle seems impossible. I know this already. Alone, unsure, dwarfed by the scale of the enemy, remember this. Freedom is a pure idea. It occurs spontaneously and without instruction. Random acts of insurrection are constantly occurring throughout the galaxy. There are whole armies, battalions that have no idea that they've already enlisted in the cause and know this. The day will come when all these skirmishes and battles, these moments of defiance, will have flooded the banks of the Empire's authority. And then there will be one too many. One single thing will break the siege. Remember this. Try." And along these same lines, Andor's adoptive mother, Marva Andor, says, "Remember that the frontier of the rebellion is everywhere, and even the smallest act of insurrection pushes our lines forward. And then remember this. The imperial need for control is so desperate because it is unnatural. Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks, it leaks. Authority is brittle. Oppression is the mask of fear. Remember, there is darkness reaching like rust into everything around us. We let it grow, and now it's here. It's here, and it's not visiting anymore. It wants to stay. The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It is never more alive than when we sleep. It's easy for the dead to tell you to fight, and maybe it's true. Maybe fighting is useless. Perhaps it's too late, but I'll tell you this. If I could do it again, I'd wake up early, and I'd be fighting these bastards from the start. Fight the Empire." These are all stirring words, and frankly, some of the best entertainment writing of the year. But here, the enemy is obvious. And historically, it was obvious that slaves would revolt against Rome in the 70s BCE, or the Jews in the 60s CE, or that in 19th century, Greece would rebel against the Ottomans, and later in World War I, the Arabs would join them. Gandhi's peaceful campaigns in India, or the violent ones in Indochina in the 1940s and 1950s. Whether it be Romans, Turks, British, or French, these were foreign rulers imposing tyranny on subject peoples. This is in the spirit of Andor, and this tyranny is easy to spot, clearly seen if for no reason other than the ethnicity is different, something lacking in Andor. And this is where Andor is actually sort of clever. We can see the Imperial forces because of the uniforms, especially those of the stormtroopers. I mean, they wear basically all white sort of semi-armor. So it's always easy to see, and the officers usually are in black with caps. We know who the enemy is in that case. But at one point, one of the characters in Andor dresses like the locals, mixes in. You don't know friend or foe in that moment. The one thing, though, that Andor does, of course, sort of divorce itself from is that beginning that I had mentioned at the prequel, that the Empire is not some sort of foreign invading force, as I would say with the Romans or the British in India. No, instead, it began inside the Republic itself. This is one of the keys. It's easy to understand a British Empire or a Roman one. It's easy to resist that kind of thing, as Marva Andor does. Easy to resist the real-world Jean Moline. The Nazis were fairly obvious in their horror. But there is also a creeping level of tyranny that is equally insidious, yet much harder to spot. And that is when the tyranny begins from the inside. And remember all of those examples I started out the podcast with? Napoleon, Mussolini, Lenin, Stalin, Russia's current ruler Putin, and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. None of them were foreigners. None of them led massive armies into these countries. They began from the inside. One of the greatest mistakes made by humans throughout history is to put their fates into the power of the state, usually in the form of a strong man, or more recently, we're going to start to see this, strong woman. I would start with the example of Argentina in which Christine Kirchner still wields vast power. But these people, they vow to fix all the problems and make things work. The trains will run on time. When progressive New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman yearns for the U.S. to be China for a day, he means that our republic, at least in that wonderful day of authoritarianism, could build shiny new airports, office towers, and whole cities as the Chinese have done over the past 30 years. Friedman would look at the 2006 Beijing Olympics and marvel at the 5,000-strong drum corps. There are two things very wrong with Friedman's vision. First, a lot of the reasons we can't be China for a day and build gleaming airports and do new roads, or even in the case of California, preserve water, is because of the creeping nature of the regulatory state, something Friedman, of course, conveniently omits in his narratives. The other thing is, these things are accomplished through coercion. If Friedman's column began to question the government, you know, Mr. China for a day would probably find himself in jail in China with a sentence probably notably longer than a day. China doesn't accomplish all of these things because they have a better system of governance. They accomplish all of these because they can dictate it, because the state runs everything, because there is a lack of liberty. I don't want that road built through my house. Screw you. We're going to take your house and we're going to build the damn road. The other aspect of when progressives yearn for this type of vast control is that it is only reasonable to set their priorities and beliefs. But let's be clear, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. If the GOP were China for a day and removed regulatory barriers, eliminated public sector unions, and franchised more charter schools, and cut the staff of the Labor Department, the hue and cry would be heard all the way to Chinese-occupied Tibet. And it should be noted that the government that Friedman extols is actually run by colonizers and people who run mass concentration camps. Not only does in this case tyranny emanate from within, but the illusion that it is weak and ready to be torn down, as was extolled in the show Andor, it's unfortunately not correct. Bonaparte was torn down, but only after he unwisely invaded Russia with the eventual loss of most of his army. It was the same with Adolf Hitler. So both had played the long game, not overestimated their forces, and underestimated Russia's size. It would have been interesting to see how long it would have been taken to tear them down. Is the authoritarian era really that brittle, as Marva Andor says in the show? I say, what about the person on the other side of World War II Eastern Front, apart from the guy sitting on the other side from Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin? Was he torn down? During his career, he probably murdered something like 30 million people across Russia. Yet Stalin was never torn down. Rather, he died in his bed in 1953 after a near 25-year rule. If you asked even knowledgeable people with a smattering of history who was the greatest mass murderer in history, in terms of total numbers, one would usually hear Adolf Hitler. The correct answer is actually Mao Zedong, the ruler of China, with nearly 40 million Chinese dead under his watch. Of course, this sort of question is clearly a race to the bottom. Adolf Hitler and Mao Zedong are both terrible figures. But did the Chinese rise up and overthrow Mao when he did his great leap forward in the late 1950s? No, he died in 1976 at the age of 82 years old. The current ruler of China, Xi Jinping, lauds Mao and wishes to even emulate him. Despite this, there is no movement, no rebels on hand to overthrow Xi's form of tyranny. Next door, we now have the third member of the Kim dynasty in North Korea. And in terms of rebellion, there is little evidence that Kim Jong-un, that third member, has any more issues than his father and his grandfather, who again, both died in their beds. Now, let me be very clear on this. The lesson here is never to appease tyranny. One of the great lessons of history, and it's even of human nature, is that when you have a tyrant, or even that schoolyard bully, the one thing is that if you give in to them, the lesson that they will learn is their tyranny, their bullying, it works. That is the lesson that they will take away. Decent people might walk away from that. But none of the people I've named, none of these historical figures are exactly what I would call decent people. No, the key lesson here is that freedom, that liberty, must be constantly maintained. Vigilance is always in order. As Ronald Reagan said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for. It must be protected and handed on for them to do the same. And also to note that much of tyranny in history did not begin by imposition from so-called visitors in the Andor speech. The tyrannies of Germany, Russia, Cambodia, Cuba, and Venezuela were not from invading armies, but at one point were supported by the peoples of these nations and maintained not by a conquering colonist foe, but by the apparatus of the state. Despite the growing threat, there is little for the United States to actually fear from a Chinese invasion in some sort of Red Dawn movie fever dream. That means that the greatest threat to our liberty will come from within. We can see the cold thread of tyranny and the icicles forming on our republic's eaves. These icicles come in speech codes that limit what a person can say or write. Now, I'm not talking even about pure hate speech, such as a work that extols mass violence. Instead, these codes would eliminate centuries-old words, such as master, housekeeping, lame, minority, and grandfather. People take offense to these words, but instead of expressing that offense or debating what those terms mean, the left would use the coercive power of government to censor speech. We see it in schools. We see it in a regulatory world where a simple thing like a gas stove has then been deemed a threat and thus be eliminated. In this case, our liberties will succumb to tyranny not by a violent revolution, but rather in dribs and drabs. As Marva Andor did state in her speech, in the slow, while we are sleeping, only to awake to that state. Now, I just wanted to make a quick comment on the gas stove controversies. A lot of my fellow conservatives have fortunately debunked the theory that somehow this is something we as conservatives made into a culture war. Richard Trumka, the head of the Consumer Protection Agency, clearly stated he wanted to eliminate gas stoves, and it's actually being done in New York and proposed in California today. So, this is not something we drummed up. This is my issue with it. I am not necessarily an agnostic on climate change. I could see that the emissions that we pump into the air through our internal combustion engines and all of our heating might have a deleterious effect on climate. I'm open to that. But here's the thing about the gas stove controversy. Number one, there is absolutely no science that the gas stove emissions will alter our ozone layers or our climate under any circumstances. Simply no studies, no science, if you will, that is often used as a cudgel. But the other one is a little bit more insidious. Realizing that it couldn't be used as a climate change cudgel, the left immediately pivoted to the concept that it's a health issue. In other words, that asthmatic children, might succumb to that. But once again, there is absolutely no conclusive studies supporting this. So here's the difference. Climate change, or even the concept of an unvaxxed person, right, who doesn't get the vaccines and somehow makes somebody else sick, represents a threat, a societal threat. But a gas stove is something inside the house. It's something for a parent to decide, to learn the risks of a gas stove, assuming it exists, and, I would argue, play against the risks of a electrical stove. Electrical fires are things. There's over 50,000 electrical fires in the United States on a yearly basis. This should be for the parents, the homeowners, to decide. It's one thing to try to limit the emissions of an automobile that operates in a societal state. But this is in-home, and this involves children, and that decision should be left to the homeowners and the parents, not the state. The gas stove, again, represents one of those tiny little invasive kind of things that will eventually grow, in which all of our liberties are dictated to us by the state. Here's another example of that sleeping only to awake. In March 2020, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was lauded for going into extreme lockdown mode in the first wave of the COVID invasion. However, aside from the ease of doing this on a two-island nation, it was noted in The Guardian that it was not to last. If one can date the government's decline, that would be August 2021. On that breezy winter Tuesday, the Prime Minister announced the country would move to alert level 4 at midnight. Back then, public compliance was high, and the team of 5 million did its duty. That initial lockdown, though, would drag into December, as the Delta variant proved a more formidable opponent than the initial coronavirus variant. Yet compliance remained high, with movement data indicating similar patterns to previous level 4 and level 3 lockdowns in Auckland. Now keep in mind these numbers. The original COVID invasion that we understand it, the original disease, was really a known entity in March of 2020. But here we have August 2021, in which Ardern and her government are reimposing serious restrictions. Now, when the usual cast of conspiracists turned out to protest the lockdown in August of 2021, they could muster no more than 100 supporters. And yet, 6 months later, some members of that same cast managed to turn out thousands of people for the convoy to Wellington. How? What distinguished the country's first extended lockdown in March 2020 from its second in August 2021 was that the first lockdown came with the social and financial support needed to sustain it. Alongside freezing tax interest, freezing rents, and banning evictions came hundreds of millions of dollars in direct support to social service providers and a six-month mortgage holiday scheme for homeowners. But unfortunately, a similar commitment to preventing hardship was absent in the August 2021 lockdown. And as Alert Level 4 and Alert Level 3 dragged on in Auckland, stories were breaking that detailed precisely what that hardship began to look like. This is what did in the government's strong support from New Zealanders, allowing communities to fracture as hardship went unanswered and unsupported. And this was one of the ways that liberty started to get limited in New Zealand. So initially we have this disease that occurs in March of 2020, and the government provides all of these responsiveness to this. Yet, in August of 2021, the government then takes those things away, and New Zealanders are like, wait a minute, this isn't what we signed up for. Well, too bad. It took them 6 months after the protests began for the Ardern government to take away those restrictions. And even today, in January of 2023, New Zealand is still struggling to get back onto an economic footing because of those lockdowns. Now, this is a case study in government beginning with a presumably beneficial offering, keeping you from getting a disease, but it morphed into something else, especially a year later when it was shown that COVID was a threat, but not consistently dire to those over 65. For those younger kids, it was the equivalent with the flu, though this did not stop the zealousness of Ardern. I have written a great deal about 2012's Obama ad, Life of Julia. Julia, who in this video that features her, has no face. She is depicted at ages 3 through 67 enjoying the benefits of various Obama-backed welfare state programs. As a toddler, she's in Head Start. At 17, she's enrolled at a Race to the Top high school. Her 20s are active. She gets surgery and free birth control through Obamacare regulations. She files a lawsuit under the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act and pays off her student loans at a low interest rate. We get updates at age 31, 37, and 42, and then the narrative skips ahead 23 years when she enrolls in Medicare. 2 years later, she's on Social Security, at which point, well, she can die anytime. I always love what is missing from the Life of Julia video. There's no family, there's no friends, there's no churches, charities, and there's not even a spouse. What is there is that all of this largesse is not even granted by the American government or the people. It is provided by, quote, under President Obama, unquote, because like China Xi, he almost seemingly is there for life. The other side of the coin, not mentioned in the video, and this is my point about New Zealand, was that what the government gives, it can later take away. The threat is implicit in any governmental program in a way not relevant in the free market. And sadly, this is where one of the aspects of the Marva Andor speech is wrong. She says that tyranny is unnatural. Unfortunately, the history of humanity shows that it is very natural. And not natural in terms, again, of just somebody wanting to rule over somebody else, but rather somebody ceding their authorities, their liberties, their freedoms to somebody else for safety and security. This is what we see in the life of Julia. I have been quoting from the writers of a TV show, Andor, but I wanted to leave you with the genius of one of the greatest thinkers of our time, Thomas Sowell. If you do not know who Thomas Sowell is, please check him out, dear listener. What is ominous is the ease with which some people go from saying they don't like something to saying that the government should forbid it. Don't expect freedom to survive very long when you go down that road. What is history but the story of how rulers and politicians have squandered the blood and treasure of the human race? And now, let me conclude with a quote once again from Ronald Reagan. There are those in America today who have come to depend absolutely on government for their security. And when government fails, they seek to rectify that failure in the form of granting government more power. So as government has failed to control, let's say, crime and violence with the means given it by the Constitution, they seek to give it more power at the expense of the Constitution. Yet in doing so, in their willingness to give up their freedoms and liberties in the name of safety, the people are really giving up their protection from what has always been the chief source of despotism, government. This is Bell Avis. Thanks for listening to the latest Conservative Historian podcast. Check out all of our podcasts. We have over 150 of them, and we are on all the major directories. Once again, thanks for listening.